Greetings, Earth Explorers. Welcome to X Squared Radio. I'm your host, Brooks Agnew. As you know, we're coming to you live from an undisclosed location east of the Appalachian Mountains.
The spice expands consciousness. The spice is vital to space travel.
This is where the past meets the future. In here, of course, the results are always positive. Now, we might go a little past your imagination, but have no fear. You will safely be traveling with us. Whether you are driving across the country tonight or working on your favorite project, you are about to find out more about who we are, why we are here, and what we may become than you thought possible. Lots of science going on tonight. We're going to start right out with it. The solar wind is up to 425 kilometers per second and is loaded with high-energy protons. There are eight, count them, eight sunspot clusters facing us today. Big sunspot AR 1654 is crackling with C and M-class solar flares, and it poses a threat for even stronger eruptions. NOAA forecasters estimate a 5% chance of X flares today or tomorrow. And we're all watching for filaments to form between these clusters scattered across the sun's surface. If they form, linking several clusters together, their power increases substantially. If the filament snaps, it will lash a CME out into space like a solar bullwhip toward Earth. I also want you to be aware that there is something cosmological coming that is going to make many people nervous. Later this year, Comet Ison could put on an unforgettable display as it plunges toward the sun for a fiery encounter, likely to turn the dirty snowball into a naked eye object in broad daylight. That's right, not just a comet at night that you can see with binoculars, but you'll be able to see it during the day. At the moment, however, it doesn't look like much. Comet Ison, also known as C2012S1, is currently in the constellation Gemini, moving between the heads of twins Castor and Pollux, says Chumak. It is still pretty faint, near 16th magnitude, but don't be fooled by that. This could become one of the best comets in many, many years, because Comet Ison is a sun grazer. On November 28th, just after Thanksgiving of this year, 2013, it will fly through the sun's outer atmosphere only 1.2 million kilometers from the stellar surface below. If the comet survives the encounter, it could emerge glowing as brightly as the moon, visible near the sun in the blue daylight sky. The comet's dusty tail stretching into the night would create a worldwide sensation. Comet Ison looks so puny now because it is so far away. Currently near the orbit of Jupiter, as it falls toward the sun in the months ahead, it will warm up and will reveal more about its true character. By the summer of 2013, researchers should know. That it was predicted before the end times. Perhaps the Maya weren't wrong after all. No, it won't affect Earth directly. It will, however, have an effect on human consciousness. Is this the sign of the Son of Man? Is this the blue kachina? One thing is for sure. A daytime visible comet is a once in a century, perhaps once in a millennia. Better get ready to think about space a little differently. Before we bring our guest on, Dr. David Martin, let's try another Skype connection. We're cutting out just a little bit. Want to make sure this is crystal clear tonight. Hold on. We'll be right back. Don't go away. All right, let's try that. Is that cleaner? All right, we're back online. Here we go. Hold on one just minute here as I restart the file, and then we'll be rocking. For some reason, the internet has really been choppy lately. It could just be the quality of the packets that are going back and forth. Let me tell you a little bit about our guest. Tonight's guest is Dr. David Martin. He is the founder and chairman of MCAM, Inc., the international leader of innovation, finance, trade, and intangible asset finance. Actively engaged in global ethical economic development, Dr. Martin's work includes financial engineering and investment, public speaking, writing, and providing financial advisory services to the majority of countries in the world. Dr. Martin is the architect and founder of the Global Innovation Commons and is the author of the International Legal Framework for the Heritable Knowledge Trust and Heritable Innovation Trust programs. He has pioneered global programs to bring corporate and stock market transparency to the multinational extractive industries and has been instrumental in repatriating value to countries which have been subject to corporate and financial abuses. Let me tell you something, Earth explorers. Times of trouble often demand a superhero to arrive in the nick of time to straighten everything out. That's my friend, Dr. David Martin. Welcome to the program.
Brooks, it's great to be here with you.
This is going to be fun. You know, the synergy of tonight's broadcast is just amazing. Just a couple of days ago, we were reading articles and talking about, the $1 trillion coin that the administration was thinking about minting to try to get around the regulations on gold and silver so they could kind of deposit it in the bank and, you know, clear off a few zeros and give themselves some more money to spend. And I thought, that's just crazy. Who thinks like that? Who floats ideas like that? You know, there's got to be an expert out there that can really tell us what is going on. You know, the science of society and laws and economy is more complex and thus more cloak and dagger than most people can comprehend. So how do we see what's behind the curtain here? What's going on with all this global economy that we see?
Well, Brooks, it's fascinating when you think about the $1 trillion coin and the nuance that was the contrivance that supported the idea, which was that the rules governing currency and coinage in the United States actually are legacies of the debates that transpired at the end of the last century. Historical references will obviously recall William Jennings Bryan's Cross of Gold speech, the very famous debates between gold and silver as the coinage of the country before the foundation of the Federal Reserve gold-backed system. But what you find fascinating about this debate is that since 1971, which is when your listeners will recall the Nixon administration took us off of any standard-based currency, what we have found is that all forms of money, regardless of their coinage, regardless of whether they're paper or gold or silver or copper, which are the three metals that we actually regulate, the fact of the matter is every bit of our monetary system has been a consensus illusion. And that consensus illusion is maintained until it stops being maintained. And when that stops, crazy ideas come out, like this idea that somehow or another minting a $1 trillion platinum coin would somehow be a way for the President of the United States to actually meet the obligations provided under the 14th Amendment. And this kind of craziness is just the latest in a presidency that was procured for the benefit of those who sought to conduct the largest wealth transfer in our modern history. And that's exactly what they're doing.
Well, I mean, boy, you drop a lot right there. First of all, what does it do to the game if you make a $5 million bill in the game of Monopoly? Doesn't that kind of screw the game up?
Well, this game got screwed up a long time ago. It got screwed up when we decided that we would decouple our monetary policy from our national productivity. And by doing that, we actually began slipping down a slippery course that, thankfully, we've had numbers of wars and contrived conflicts that have kept the illusion at bay. Remember that had it not been for certain events in 2001, we would have had the expiration of the first 30-year treasuries after the Nixon administration lifting the gold standard. And we mysteriously found ourselves on the day before we actually had debt due, suddenly falling into the national madness of having to deal with enemies that we created so that we could actually defer the obligations that we had. And it turns out that, not unlike that, when we confront the obligations that this country has continued to pile up, we have a phenomenal track record of kicking the can down the road by creating cover stories and conflicts, which actually do a wonderful job of deferring accountability till those who are currently in power are out of power. And then it's somebody else's time to be imaginative and come up with the next way to defer accountability.
Well,
accountability cannot be perpetually deferred. And what we've got now is a multi-trillion-dollar problem that faces us in the first two quarters of fiscal year 2013, when in addition to reaching the debt ceiling limit, which most people are familiar with, we also have another $2.3 trillion of Treasury debt that becomes due, and we currently do not have an extra $2.3 trillion rattling around in our pockets to pay for that debt.
Well, that's true. And, the thing that fascinates me and confuses me at the same time, and that's almost irresistible for a scientist, we just have to figure out a way to crack it open and figure out how it works, is that generation after generation of politicians and bureaucrats walk away from the game with their pockets stuffed with cash for the rest of their lives. And I'm not just talking about presidents and cabinet members. I'm talking about hundreds of thousands of bureaucrats every single year that walk out of this system with pension plans worth way more than any private sector person could gather in a career. And it's as though they are not involved in the American process, because the greed with which they have, and I'm going to use a Southern word, singed, which is a way of using a net to get all the minnows out of a pond so you don't have to fish out. You know, you get all the bait out of the pond in one time. They've singed the Treasury and put our nation in this precarious position. It's as though they don't have to live here. It's as though they don't watch the news. They don't see what's going on to John Q. Public as our savings are being squandered. And you think, well, no, they're not reaching into my savings account and actually grabbing money. No, they're taking the money and snipping it into little pieces so that it's worth even less.
Yeah, well, if you go back in time, you'll realize that on September 10th, 2001, there's a very fascinating convergence which would have been entirely ignored had it not been for the inconvenience of having video and having the legacy of data that cannot easily be erased. But you'll recall that on September 10th, 2001, Donald Rumsfeld made the rather horrific and shocking statement that there was $2.3 trillion missing, and those were his words.
Yeah, I remember
from,
that.
An accountability review of the Department of Defense's expenditures. Now, obviously, we all know that the next day, that story got no traction because there happened to be another story that took over. But we were missing $2.3 trillion. And the funny thing is, when you say you're missing $2.3 trillion in 2001, and you are the Secretary of Defense, and you've just been audited, and there's this missing $2.3 trillion, one would think that someone somewhere would say, that's a lot to go missing. But
But if you'll remember, I think that the congressperson that asked the question after the audit in the congressional hearing was Sheila Jackson Lee.
Yes.
That has no, I'm going to say, no authority. It was just a front person put out there to ask the question. And Rumsfeld answered, well, we don't know where it is. And that was it. There was nothing there. There was no follow-up.
And there isn't because, to your point, the shareholders who benefit from this wealth transfer are actually in a world that transmits themselves and their accountability to a level that is really quite staggering. When you think about the fact that the idea of the rule of law, which is something that you and I think of as something that at least remotely obligates us into how we comport ourselves in our lives, the rule of law has been something which clearly, for a select few, has been absolutely suspended. And when you think about the fact that you have these massive, massive sums of money, which are publicly disclosed to have been misappropriated, there is no court, there is no subject anywhere on earth which allows a public interest to be served in inquiring as to precisely who benefited from those funds and where those funds actually went.
Well, you're absolutely right. In fact, I just read an article today in the Caller that was talking about that very thing, where you have John Corzine and you have our own Treasury Secretary, Mr. Geithner, who is, you know, one of the biggest, you know, tax scammers in history. And it's well known, but it's all swept under the carpet. There is no, if there is a rule of law, there's no respect for it. There's no.
Well, remember that just before Christmas, in one of the most egregious abuses of civil society and of jurisprudence in the United States, HSBC, who was, in their words, quote, profoundly sorry for having done money laundering for drug cartels around the world and transferring billions of dollars of funds, was, and I'm quoting, profoundly sorry when they were caught and wound up getting exculpated of any liability for the mere sum of $1.9 billion that they paid. And when they paid $1.9 billion as a fine for money laundering, they said that they had ample funds to cover the charges and it wouldn't have a material impact on their business.
In other words,
now,
it was.
Stop
it
and
was
think a, about the fact that we have drug lords, we have rogue states, we have all sorts of things that are getting financed by regulated capital markets. And when they get caught for violations of these are massive, massive federal and international crimes, they are, quote, profoundly sorry, and to use your Monopoly game metaphor, get to pay a $1.9 billion get-out-of-jail-free card, and they go on to rob the bank again.
And, no prosecutions took place. And I wonder if they're profoundly sorry for 3% of the American population that's incarcerated because of their pumping drugs onto our streets. Almost 19% of the black population has had some run-in with the law due to drugs being pushed into their community that's been financed by HSBC.
Well, I think they're profoundly sorry for getting caught. I think at the end of the day, there's an awful lot of folks who actually find that when you're doing something horrifically illegal that costs real lives and leads to the death of hundreds or thousands of individuals and leads to the impoverishment of our society, I think what they're really saying they're sorry about is the fact that they got busted. The fact is that this kind of behavior, to the broader point, happens without any, at any level of accountability, actually pushed into the realm that would be certainly put into action if, for example, some street dealer in Charlotte, North Carolina, or some street dealer in Washington, D.C., was actually involved in the scale that they'd be doing on a money laundering basis, they would actually be in federal penitentiaries because, obviously, they do not have $1.9 billion of spare change floating around to pay for a fine and be, quote, profoundly sorry.
So are you saying that there are two standards of law, one for the wealthy and one for the common person?
Well, I would like to suggest that I don't think that there is actually a standard of law for the those who actually purchase the incumbency. I had the good fortune of spending some time with the U.S. Department of Justice a few months ago, and I was talking to one of the senior officials in the antitrust division about a very large collusion and extortion racket that's happening in the United States. And I was pointing out the fact that there was no question that there was an extortion racket that was actually quite alive and well, to which this official happened to say, well, while you've established that the extortion is probably going on, for us to be really vigorous in our pursuit of it, we really need to be able to prove that the extorters are colluding. And after saying those words in that very fashion, he stopped himself and said, and I'm quoting, that probably sounded worse than I meant it to sound.
My goodness. So did this person happen to work in William Withholder's office?
No question.
All right. Well, that shows enough. You know, our press colleague, Sean Hannity, says people that are fed up with a power-hungry, radicalized, abusive federal government intruding into every aspect of our lives, people are going to say they're fed up, and states are going to want more liberty and more freedom. They're not going to want to tax their citizens to death anymore. If this pattern continues and gets worse and worse and worse, I can see at some point the states saying, forget it. I don't want to be a part of this union anymore. What do you think is the play here? I only got you for another half an hour, so I really want to be get to the end game here. We obviously cannot let these Taliban drug lords continue any longer, pushing heroin and opium and marijuana into our communities and ruining us and addicting us and impoverishing us. What are we going to do about it? I mean, obviously the war on drugs is a moot point. There is no war on drugs. There's only a war on the people that use drugs.
Well,
so,
and there's not actually much of that. Remember that I had the good fortune back in the 1980s to be in Central America during the Nicaraguan conflict. And I happened to be up on the northern border of Costa Rica and Nicaragua working with the Costa Rican Ministry of Health. And I was intrigued one weekend when I was down at the beach, and I actually ran into a bunch of DEA agents and a bunch of CIA agents who were hanging out with a bunch of international friends of theirs and quite openly talking about the fact that there was, in their experience, not only no legitimate war on drugs, but remember back then, Carlos Leder was the kind of the devil incarnate. We were trying to find him under every bush, and it turns out that he actually lived in a house not far from where I was stationed. So I puzzled over how it was that if we were looking for a guy that I happened to see about three times a week, why it was that hundreds of agents weren't able to find him. And if you go back in history, what you'll find is that the reason why we have no incentive to end the war on drugs is because drugs are a phenomenal way to add liquidity to the systems of funding of covert activities. And as long as we have a government that actually perceives its role as maintaining some sort of opacity by virtue of using covert financing as its primary source of issuing its edicts and wills on the rest of the world, the fact of the matter is we have no incentive whatsoever to actually stop any part of the, quote, war on drugs. To the contrary, like the British before us, and certainly we're doing it quite well right now in Afghanistan, our intent is to make sure that the drugs continue to flow so that the currency that we move throughout the world to support the nefarious and the occult exercises that are most desirable for those who don't like to live in the light and don't like to live in transparency, those individuals will continue to support that wonderfully opaque means of transferring wealth. And like the HSBC case, like many other cases preceding, you will find that when a few folks get caught, there's a little ruffle, a few feathers get knocked out of place, and then before long it all comes back to normal.
Well, you speak of drugs as a currency. There are other currencies, like, for instance, one of the things that we do almost the best in the world here in this country is we make cars. And we have a lot of cars. We have a lot of used cars. We have a lot of used cars in our system that are unowned right now. And those dealers that have those used cars on their lot would love to sell them. But when someone walks on their lot with, let's say, $12,000 in cash and says, I'd like to buy that car, and they have a driver's license or a passport, and they put down the money and they buy that car, we as car dealers have to report that $12,000 to the IRS, and the TSA will examine to see where that money came from and make sure that when that car gets exported, say to South Africa or to Afghanistan or wherever, and then is resold and turned back into currency, that that currency is not used for a nefarious purpose. And they will trace that VIN number, that car, all the way to its end destination. But they won't trace drugs. They won't stop those.
Not in the least.
That's just insane. So in this quandary that we find ourselves in, sorry to in a sentence, in a preposition, but we have experts. We have forensic experts like yourself that know what's going on, and they have the training and the education to be able to quantify that and to be able to map that and, you know, produce a process flow diagram and a control plan and actually create a feedback system that could stop that. Why isn't that being implemented? Why is there not, I mean, is there no one in our government that believes in truth, justice, in the American way?
Well, I must say that in my experience, and this is what I have found to be the painful reality, certainly as long as I've been actively involved in these processes, which goes back much longer than my age should implicate, the answer is that the idea of transparency is anathema to our current practice of government. And what you find is that when you bring matters into the public, into the light, you are supposed to be able to sort what is disclosable from what isn't. And the idea that somewhere somebody can use a common decency standard like the rule of law or like moral certitude as a standard for disclosure is something that you and I would think would be a fairly logical thing. We actually talk about freedom and justice and transparency and democracy, and we talk about those as ideals, but you have to recall that the organizations that are in place, that we look to as those things which are the governing bodies that are supposed to be the eyes minding the store, in fact are the perpetrators far too often. And so when you point out things that are untoward, when you point out things that clearly are happening in harm not only to the United States, but to allies and people all over the world, what you find is that you're actually not welcome to do that, and the number of people who are incented not to see those things get the light of day is actually quite high, which is part of the reason why in a lot of the work that we've done, we actually find ourselves ultimately disclosing the truth in the form of metaphor and novel, because you cannot actually get people to pay attention to the absolute transparent truth.
Right. It's like science fiction often puts out, you know, our best technology to the people and what we understand about perhaps our relationship in the galaxy, you know, so that it kind of makes it, you know, palatable to people. Now, you have written just such a novel. The title of it is Coup de 12. You mind telling us a little about what you did with a novel to try to get the reader to understand what's really going on at the highest levels of international government?
Well, in the same way that the Peugeot Commission of 1912, and for those of you who have not looked into the Peugeot Commission of 1912, I encourage the reading of their reports, because it was actually a very similar situation. The government was very clearly purchased. The economy of the United States was very clearly purchased by a few very interesting shareholders back in the period of time from 1898 to 1910. And there was a commission set up by Arsène Pujol, who actually was impaneled to look into the interlocking directorates and the shareholders that at the time controlled the economics of the United States. Not unlike that period of time, in the late 1990s, a group of 12 individuals got together forming a business called White House 08. And the principle of that business was to actually purchase the national election in 2008. The idea of that purchase was actually to find a way to identify the person who would be most electable from the standpoint of public opinion polls and marketing studies and surveys and so forth, and bring together the resources to actually manage both sides, the Democrat and the Republican side of the ticket, to ensure that the person that landed in the Oval Office in 2008 was their person. That event actually took place. The actual event of establishing that business took place. That event took place in New York City. And very recently, one of the organizers of that event actually surfaced again as he started looking at how to rob the U.S. government again, this time using a very carefully concocted way of getting municipalities to use financial powers to actually take property from the public and actually shift it into private sector investors. But this particular individual pulled together 12 shareholders, and that is the point of departure for Coup de 12. And Coup de 12 goes on to lay out the dynamics of how that particular plan was executed and the moving pieces in that plan, which actually included, and as readers of the book will find, included things up to and including a flooded metro tunnel between Hoboken and Manhattan right before the election that just took place. So when you read the book, you'll find out that not only the events of the past are laid out, but when you realize the book was written a year and a half before things like earthquakes at Lake Anna Nuclear Power Plant in Richmond, Virginia, that wonderfully seismic active area, when you find out that a past tunnel station is identified in the book having been flooded, something that had not happened before, you'll see that not only did the events that happen actually play into a very interesting strategic plan, but you'll actually see that the events that you are now experiencing are actually part of the ongoing execution of that plan.
The thing that I found most amazing about this is that this region of the country is not very tectonically active. In fact, I had just come out of the Pentagon when that earthquake hit. Now, I knew what it was because I'm a California boy. I grew up there. I know what they are. We have that season comes around every year. But Virginians didn't know what that was, and they poured out of the Pentagon like rats because they thought they were under attack again. They'd never felt the whole building shake like that. That was a very rare event. And I am amazed when I read that in your book. I'm going, how in the world did David Martin know there was going to be an earthquake in Virginia, of all places?
Yeah, well, that's the kind of thing that, unfortunately, as many people try to just point to serial coincidences that just happen to have fallen in a particular order. Serial coincidences are one thing, and then when, to your point, you have something as ridiculous as a earthquake that happens to be close to two very strategic resources that don't get any attention, the Lake Anna Nuclear Power Plant and the Federal Reserve Data Center in Richmond, you put those two things together, and you put them together in the context of what's going on, and lo and behold, things start making sense. And so coincidences are one thing. Serial coincidences are another thing. And yet on top of that, coincidences with intent are a whole new game. And what's happened and what continues to happen is that we are fed these improbable and implausible stories, and we are told to just accept them as though all of a sudden Born Identity or some other kind of political thriller is just happening to play out in real life, and art is imitating life and life is imitating art, and the whole line between those things gets blurred. But the fact of the matter is the theatrics are in fact real, and The theatrics are happening, and They are masking the perpetrators of immense wealth transfer, who, by the way, to answer your earlier question, really do not see themselves beholden to a nation-state position. They see themselves transcending the realities that were put in place with the Treaty of Westphalia and the systems that were developed as a result of that nation-state emergence. These are individuals who literally see themselves as stateless actors, who are like the terrorists that they teach us to fear, equally incapable of acting for the common good, as are those who seek to do harm.
Well, you know, those that act this way, that are above the structure of nation states, not unlike ancient Rome, I might add, I guess the only thing that they would fear is real, true exposure. And when I think of real, true exposure, novels are nice, movies are nice, but how about releasing a couple of million emails or cables, official cables, actually exposing it? And that's why, at least I personally think that Julian Assange should have been given the Nobel Peace Prize. He was possibly the only reporter in the world that was actually doing some reporting. And he did not alter a thing. The only thing he revealed is the crimes were actually perpetrated.
Well, and Julian represents a very fascinating dimension that I believe is going to be coming with greater clarity over the next months and years to come. As you know, one of the great kind of covert realities has been that institutions like large financial players have been used for many, many decades as a anonymization tool for those individuals and those interests who seek to remain operating in the shadows. And what you find is that increasingly, as the loyalty and economic hegemony of those large institutions starts cracking, I think you're going to see an increased number of individuals who do start taking, as they leave their offices in downsizing exercises in New York and in Chicago and other places, I think you're going to see more people who, in an effort to extract their last pound of vindication for what they perceive to be injustice, they are going to be taking these records, and I think we're going to see a lot more releases in the days and weeks to come. I think you're going to see an enormous amount of individuals who decide that the anonymity that they were incentivized to protect is only valued insofar as they're receiving some quid in the pro quo for their silence. You'll find is that an increasing number of people feeling as though their interests have been harmed when they get downsized out of existence are likely going to extract their pound of flesh. And as you know, when those chips start leaking. Think about the recent LIBOR scandal. Think about the rather interesting Goldman Sachs traders' departures recently. You'll find that those pounds of flesh are actually cutting really close to the heart of the institution.
Oh, absolutely. Absolutely. Every 401k in the country rests on that. Just for the listeners, I know we've briefly talked about the LIBOR scandal on this program, and then we've heard about it on the news, but no really, you know, good explanation. What was the LIBOR scandal?
Well, what it was and what it continues to be is that the London Interbank Rate, which, as most people will understand, is an enormously important rate for exchange of funds between financial institutions, the clearing rate of funds, is something that is supposed to be a relatively neutral figure that actually gives some indication of the base cost of money as it is exchanged between financial institutions. And that serves as then the basis for credit that is extended on top of that. So every mortgage holder, every car borrower, every credit card holder has their rate calculated, and typically at the bottom of that calculation is this thing called LIBOR. The way the scandal worked was that to reconcile aberrations in individual institutions, a group of individuals quite literally would get on phones or by email and essentially negotiate with each other how to balance each other's books by manipulating the rate. And so at any point in time, you might give a little bit of bump to one institution versus another, and over a period of time, this rolling self-protective mechanism became a way to make the financial institutions that were participating in setting LIBOR actually immune from some of their own self-inflicted wounds while placing the burden of that on the public. And once again, the public was actually charged a tax. And that tax was an inflation of a rate of capital cost, which actually was not based in any sense of reality. It was actually only based in the greed and corruption of the financial institutions involved. It was, Brooks, in no uncertain terms, theft. It was actual theft. It was a felony. And as you know, we have yet in the United States to see a single culprit identified and prosecuted for something that if you or I would walk into a financial institution and just pocket money and walk out with it, you know where we'd go.
Well, yeah, absolutely. I mean, we heard the vice president in the last election cycle talk about some legislation that was trying to be put forth in the Republican platform to let Wall Street begin to participate in Main Street again. And the vice president said that the Republicans were trying to unchain Wall Street. And you and I had discussed this when we met in Holland last year, that the only chains that have been anywhere within 24 blocks of Wall Street have been made of gold. They're, you know, all of the criminal activity, felonious activity that's taken place in that part of the country, that financial district, there have been no prosecutions during the entire tenure of William Holder.
Now, and remember that we're talking about, and I want you to listen to this because this number actually is really important. We're talking about $350 trillion of financial instruments that were directly pinned to this rate manipulation. Now, $350 trillion. If you move a percentage point, even a fraction, on $350 trillion of instruments, you wind up moving wealth literally in the amount of the GDP of any country.
Yeah, it's enough to buy an army. It's enough to buy a country.
Well, beyond that, remember that the global GDP, if we take away all the noise and the manipulation that we use when we calculate it, the global GDP probably sits somewhere between $35 and $50 trillion. So what we're talking about is something that actually has at least five times more consequence than the total productivity of every economy on the planet.
Unbelievable. Unbelievable. It's so bold that no law enforcement officer appears to have the guts to even face it.
And this is why, by the way, Brooks, when I wrote Coup de 12, the purpose of writing that book as a novel was actually derived from a conversation I had, which was when I finished speaking to a group of people, they looked at me and they said, the brashness of this thing is so immense, it is so immense, that no one would believe it even if it was a novel. And I thought in the wake of that statement, well, why not write it as a novel, since we don't believe it anyhow? And we're not going to believe that the scale of corruption can be the size that it is. You might as well actually benchmark this moment in history in writing so that people looking back can say, well, it appears that somebody somewhere actually did see all of this happening, actually did write it down, and at least preserve a record so that, like Plato, if you think about Plato's Republic, which is one of my favorite references in Plato's Republic, is the argument around the height of injustice. And his argument is that when, and I'm simplifying and I'm actually borrowing from Eddie Izzard, the great British comedian, you know, when somebody kills one person, we call them a murderer. When they kill 5 or 10 people, we call them a serial killer. When they kill 20 people, we start finding them fascinating and we put them under a microscope and study their intentions. And when they start killing 100 or 1,000, we actually sit back and kind of wide-eyed wonderment and wonder how they get it done. And then when they kill millions of people, we actually call it national security. The idea that injustice at an epic scale somehow defies the ability for people to be able to understand and apprehend that these events are being orchestrated and planned is something that has been a bane of society, certainly alive and well in Plato's time, and we, to our discredit, have not moved very far forward in our cultural and social evolution because we continue to this day to watch these events unfold, and at no point do we have a clarion call that says enough.
Well, on the one hand, that's true officially, but unofficially, that is the general public, they did write petitions. They did sign petitions. In fact, a whole lot of states wrote them, hundreds of thousands of them. And the White House just about, 26 hours ago, politely shot down the secession petitions circulating on the White House petition website, dashing the hopes of malcontents who have submitted petitions to allow their states to withdraw from the Union in the wake of President Obama's re-election last November. Now, the general public is not real smart when it comes to legal fol-de-rol and cloak and dagger stuff. We don't really understand the nuances of law, of positioning, of graft, of LIBOR. I doubt many could even spell it. But we do know what it smells like. And that's enough for the general public. And it's almost enough for states. And right now there are 40 states, and you and I have discussed this already at another date, there are 40 states that have signed and issued into their own state law sovereignty acts,
right,
declaring their sovereignty. Now this smacks a little bit of what we used to call nullification back in 1860, but it isn't. It's more of a legal put up your duke and I'll see in court kind of move. But what does it really mean, David? What do you see happening with this states squaring off against the government? This is the first time we've had petitions for secession in 140, 50 years. So what's going on here?
Well, what's going on is an interesting battle that is actually emerging in a very odd space, and most of your listeners are actually unaware that the real center of gravity for these issues is going to be in the retirement and pension accounts of every single person that has a retirement or pension.
I'm glad you brought. I don't interrupt you. I'm putting a bookmark right here because I want to bring something up. Keep going.
But what is happening is the states are realizing that in a federal system, remember, where states have the ability to tax and generate revenue as well as the federal government, there is a very interesting problem that is on the horizon, because every state needs to be able to preserve liquidity for its operations. And when a federal act actually harms the ability for the state to act in its fiduciary capacity, then there is a real awareness in the part of many state comptrollers and state financial planners where they look into a future where they see their individual citizens of their state in high degrees of illiquidity. And that illiquidity comes from two sources. One is the illiquidity of the national government, where the cost of maintaining and the cost of supporting the debt is exceptionally high. But more importantly, the liquidity of pensions, which, as you know, is largely governed under ERISA laws, which are federal laws. Those pensions, which are forced to buy national debt, are in a position right now where they are continuing to purchase more of the illiquid security called the Treasury's debt. And over any period of time, particularly when we're looking at a double impact of both long-term suppression of interest rates, which is the environment that we've been in, which says that the yield that is required to pay off the debt is insufficient based on the rates associated with that debt, and the pension requirements, which are actually that liquidity source for citizens within each state where they're domiciled, you bring those two things together and you realize that in very short order, many states are going to find themselves without sufficient liquidity in their citizens to support their operations. And so there's a real financial incentive for states, and there's a real financial incentive for individuals within states to start looking at this issue and taking it very seriously.
And well, they're not the only ones, you know. It doesn't take too many people on the street in interviewing to ask them a question: who's buying the American debt? Well, the first word that'll roll off their lips is China. But many people may not know that for a long, long time, Japan was the second largest purchaser of American debt. But in recent years, since Fukushima, that has stopped. And China, or Japan, has stopped buying American debt. And now Japan's what's called a Keynesian economy, which maybe you can explain that to us in 25 words or less. What's happened now is that their economy is in debt, their own economy, 325% over their GDP, whereas the U.S. is about 126, 127%, which is still a lot. But Japan is completely underwater. And I heard as recently as yesterday that the powers that be are willing to let Japan go.
Well, that's an interesting thing. If you look at the actual holders of Treasury securities, there is, without question, the top holders, which are the usual suspects, are China, which actually, as of October 2012, was holding about $30 billion more debt than Japan was. But Japan was actually about 4.5 times more the combined oil exporting countries of the Gulf. So just to give you a frame of reference, Japan was actually an enormous, enormous purchaser. What you find is that, unfortunately, Japan has its own fiscal house problems. And given the trade imbalances that have come out of the geopolitical unrest happening between mainland China and Japan, particularly those aware of the geopolitical situation there are aware that the Chinese and Japanese dispute over the Northern Islands has become something that has directly impacted exports from Japan to China at a very sharp level. So Japan is actually in quite a liquidity crunch at the moment. Japan has decided that it is in a position where it can no longer continue to consume U.S. debt at the rate that it had in the past, while China has taken an official policy beginning in October of a year and a half ago, where China decided to start writing down its debt in their acknowledgement that they didn't believe the U.S. was actually ever going to be able to fully pay it back.
Well, they
put those two factors together, where you have China undercutting the value of the, quote, asset called debt, and Japan sitting on an enormous amount of this and watching its value erode. And you see that Japan has quite both a political and economic crisis on its hands, which is part of the reason why you've seen very recently the Abe government looking at how to find some sort of middle ground where they continue to be a debt buyer, but at the same time allay the concerns that are all over the Japanese public, which is that somewhere along the line we have done a great deal in the U.S. to try to coerce other countries into buying our debt while unfortunately doing very little to help stabilize and support the foreign countries that are the buyers. And quite frankly, in the case of Japan, we're now in a situation where the Japanese government is facing a loss of value, which it happens to coincide with a long-standing slump in their economy. And putting those realities together, Japan is now confronting its own meltdown, which actually has significant consequence, where you'll see, for example, depreciation of the yen that has actually been accelerating over the last few months, and you'll see an enormous imbalance of trade that continues to grow in this quarter. Put those two together and you have real instability.
Well, that's true. And, you know, the fact that you have strong companies like Toyota and Suzuki and Yamaha, but you have smaller companies that almost had a chance to thrive. Suzuki Auto just went out and was purchased by Mitsubishi. And you'll see a lot of changing hands of this just because of the falling yen. You just don't have the value in the businesses anymore. Now, let me go back to my bookmark, because there is a body that has stepped up to the plate and started purchasing this debt, and it's our old good friends down at the Federal Reserve. But the only thing they have to purchase with is printed money, and that they have been doing to the tune of about $40 to $80 billion a month. They mysteriously go to the cash drawer, and there's more cash there. But value, real value, is actually in the savings accounts, the 401ks and IRAs and pension funds of the American worker. And there's a lot of money in there. So I'm listening to the Undersecretary of the Treasury just a few days ago in an interview, and the interviewer was brilliant, asked her point blank, I want to ask you a question. Are you going to confiscate the 401ks, IRAs, and pension plans of the American worker and replace them with an IOU the way you did Social Security? And she said, absolutely not. What does that really mean, David?
Well, there's this funny thing, and one day I think we'll look back at Ron Paul's last congressional interaction with Ben Bernanke, and we'll sit there and kind of shake our heads in disbelief, where at one point Ron Paul was exasperated and kind of venting at Ben and saying how he couldn't believe the absence of transparency with which the Federal Reserve was operating. And Ben kind of looked at him in a very calm, very tranquil look, and basically confirmed what is in fact the case, and that is that the Federal Reserve can pretty much do what it wants. And until Congress decides to act to change the rules that were put in place in 1912 and 1913, there is not a bit that Congress can do to actually get the truth out of what's actually going on. Now, let's be really clear. When the Federal Reserve purchases treasuries next to your pension, so remember that when you're buying your investment with your pension, there's actually real money, and I'm using that term somewhat tongue-in-cheek since none of it's real, But there's real money coming out of your paycheck, and your paycheck is being used to purchase the treasury holdings in your pension. Standing right next to you is a guy that's using Monopoly money. And he's buying at the same time. What exactly do you suppose is happening the day you actually buy a dollar worth of treasury debt and the guy with the Monopoly money buys a dollar worth of treasury debt? The answer is your pension actually immediately becomes really 50 cents. So the truth and the lie are actually fascinating in that the truth is that the Federal Reserve is actually not picking the pocket of pensioners. The truth is that by virtue of continuously printing money and inflating the supply of money, they are actually doubly picking the pocket of pensioners. So the irony is the truth was in the answer to the question, but the wrong question was being asked. The real question was, aren't you picking the pockets twice? Because when you create money and then you allegedly purchase something with the money you created, and then you build the balance sheets of the thing that's then going to show up the next month and once again come with more money that it created to actually do it again, what happens is that the net asset value of the treasury holdings of pensioners is actually in real dollars the day the transaction happens, devalued by half, and then the next month when the same transaction happens, it is actually proportionally reduced yet again. So the devaluation is actually happening at greater than a linear scale.
That's right. That's right. Because the 50 cents that you're putting in next to the 50 cents of the Federal Reserve guy is only worth 40 cents now. And right. That's why when you look at your 401k and you see numbers in there, and I'm not going to call them dollars, you see numbers in there, let's say $150,000 in your 401k, you might think, gee, that will get me $15,000 a year for 10 years. I could live a pretty decent life supplementing my Social Security with that. But 40% of the value of those numbers has been ripped off by the Federal Reserve.
And it continues to be, particularly in the face of a monetary supply, where since the last upward inflection of actual value of securities that was actually held by the Federal Reserve, the last upward inflection which took place in the last quarter of 2007 going into the first quarter of 2008, that high point of what used to be about $800 billion has now become, in assets held by the Federal Reserve in the space of literally less than 3 years, almost three times that number. So
wow.
When you think about what that means is that the real value of the dollar that is being spent when the Fed is standing next to you buying its quote asset, we are now getting about 30 cents on our $2007 dollar.
Wow. Wow. I mean, they have to know that the only way out is the same way out that they chose in 1929. And that's to then turn around and collapse the money supply.
Well, when you pump trillions of dollars of monetary supply into the system, there's kind of only one thing that you can do to actually reconcile the actual real monetary supply to what is required to have a functioning economy, and that is you have to actually shrink it. And shrinking it is an extremely, extremely painful proposition.
Yeah. Yeah, I think about watching Greece go through what they did, and that's a small country. It's not very well vascularized when it comes to roads. Most everybody gets around with mass transit. Not everybody owns a car, so it's difficult to mobilize people, except, you know, in the streets, turn over a few cars and, you know, break a few bottles full of gasoline. But this country's very well vascularized, and people are, well, There aren't. What can you say? The problem is that right now we have about 46 million people that live on food stamps. They live on SNAP, which is kind of a food credit card. If you got just a couple of minutes, I want to play something for you. This occurred just a couple of days ago in Michigan. Let's see if I can get down to it really quick. I had a lot of notes tonight, and I haven't been scrolling through them as you have been knocking them out. What happened was that there was an agency of the government called Section 8. And what they did is they decided to put up a few vouchers and to release them to the general public. And you had to be in line. And so they put out a public announcement that, okay, you have to be in line, you know, by this time, 8 o'clock in the morning. And so you might as well bring a chair because it's going to be a long line and that kind of stuff. So what happened was the line formed the night before and it was rather chilly. And, of course, there was a little bit of, you know, being very careful to make sure that you keep your place in line. And when the office opened in the morning, it wasn't at the door that they thought it was going to be at. It was a door down the building a little ways, which caused people to have to rush toward the door. And this is what happened. Now, we're just talking about Section 8 housing, but I'm going to play this
news
audio.
Just coming into our newsroom is from Taylor. That's where police are dealing with a huge out-of-control crowd.
Let's get right to 7 Action News reporter Kim Russell, who's live at the scene. Kim, we can see the police still there right now. What's going on?
I am live on Eureka, not far, right across the street from the Taylor Human Service Center. I want you to take a look at the situation across the street right now. You can see that there are a lot of police here from numerous agencies. Brownstown, Romulus, Southgate are all helping Taylor out. We heard over the scanner that they were calling on Michigan State Police to come in riot gear to help with the situation. Here's what happened. People were lining up here, some as early as 6 o'clock last night, because Section 8 housing vouchers were supposed to be handed out this morning. Now, police, they tell me that the state didn't coordinate anyone to be here overnight to manage the crowds, and there was no one here for police to communicate with about what to do about crowds that were lining up around the block. Well, when the lights went on here, we're told that the crowds, they just ran towards the building. They wanted to make sure they got their vouchers, and police say it just got out of control, and they responded trying to disperse the crowds as if this were a riot. There were several people arrested, and I'm joined now by Rihanna Rodriguez. Thank you so much for joining me. You were telling me about some of the heartbreaking things you witnessed.
Yes, it was very heartbreaking. There was elderly, disabled people, pregnant, single women. They were here to, you know, for help to get their Section 8 vouchers. It just shows you what a desperate need that they needed it. And they were here since yesterday in the afternoon around 5, 6 o'clock. You know, that's showing you how desperate and how much they were in need of it. There was a lady that was here. She had a she had an oxygen tank. She was elderly. When they told everyone they had to go home and they weren't going to help anybody out today, she was crying. She was in tears. It broke my heart. I was here for my sister, and there was just no way we were getting anything done. And they gave everyone flyers, I guess, that were here. In the flyers, it said to come early and bring a chair. So they obviously knew it was going to be very crowded. There was going to be a large outcome of people, and they didn't prepare themselves for it, but they told us to be prepared.
All right. What the point that I want to make is not that there isn't need. Of course, there's need. Not that people aren't hungry. I've had a couple of people write me about my position on food stamps, that if you're on them, do everything you can do to get yourself off of them so that you can support yourself. I mean, everybody's been in a tough spot. College students with kids and people that lose their jobs, it happens. My point is, look what happens when the need, or when the supply of the need, gets shut off for just a couple of hours.
You know, we have, and Brooks, I have commented on this several times on my blog, Inverted Alchemy. We have built a system where we do what I refer to as surrogacy, where we assume that when things get to a certain state, there is an anonymous someone else There is a someone else that takes care of things. There is a someone else that watches over things. There is a someone else. And we've built this very interesting dependency psychology, which is actually not merely dependency the way food stamps and other social programs are discussed, but it's a dependency that assumes that when things go bad, there is a someone else. Now bear in mind, far worse than any person on food stamps is an insurance company or a bank that takes trillions of dollars of cash to make sure it can pay for its executives to get their year-end bonuses. And I don't say that lightly. The handouts are much bigger at the other end of the scale, not at the individual trying to eat or the individual trying to get their Section 8 housing voucher. But what this story in Taylor, Michigan actually really highlights is that we have no fabric, what I refer to as elasticity. We have a plastic problem in our system, and that is that the minute we see even the glimmer of hope that somebody somewhere is paying attention, somebody cares, we have this headlong rush into believing that myth, that somewhere somebody is finally taking care of what they should have cared for all along. We think that myth is being actually manifest in reality. And the fact of the matter is, we have a society that does not take seriously the implications of what that plastic feature of society is, that breakable component that doesn't have the ability to expand and contract and doesn't have the ability to be pliable. What that means is that when you have a group of individuals in Taylor, Michigan, who are told that there is going to be hope to help offset housing costs, you are going to have a massive outpouring of individuals who actually come at a point of desperation created by a system that has been so long ignoring the underlying problem. And that underlying problem is what I refer to as surrogacy, that somebody somewhere else is actually taking control of things.
Yeah,
and the illusion that somebody is taking control of things is actually worse when you have these ill-timed and ill-advised interventions that are poorly executed. And then what happens is, in fact, what happened in Michigan, which is enormous numbers of people are left disillusioned. In certain instances, people are harmed physically. You know, remember when gas stopped flowing in Atlanta a few summers ago, people were bringing guns to the gas stations because that was a good idea. Last time I actually thought a gun at a gas station was a good idea was when Bruce Willis brought a gun to a gas station in Die Hard and blew up a gas truck. But, you know, what are we thinking? And the answer is we're not. We're not paying attention to the stability that is required in a system where we, the people, have to actually take accountability and responsibility and not look to a system that is anonymized and filled with corruption as the savior that is about to show up on the scene and make everything okay. What we see in Taylor, Michigan, is just a drop in the bucket of what is likely to unfold as we go into what is, in fact, real austerity, where we start realizing that now it's not a group of people who, you know, 1,000 or 5,000 people who have housing challenges that are in the Section 8 qualified housing voucher programs in Michigan, but when we have tens or hundreds of thousands of pensioners in Florida or in North Carolina or in Georgia who suddenly find out that pension they thought had value is in fact worth less than a third of what they were told it was worth. If you think that it's tough to deal with 1,000 people in Michigan, let me tell you, 100,000 upset northerners dislocated into Florida and living on the pension that they were sure was going to take care of them in their later years, that group is not going to take the news lightly that the Federal Reserve's functional devaluation of Treasury holdings has made their retirements and their pensions illiquid.
Yeah, but the thing about it is, they already know this. All this has been explained to them by the press, by television, by radio, by newspapers. They already know this. But what the game is to skillfully blame your opponents.
Correct.
And that's where we get to this point where you got Republicans and Democrats, and they're blaming each other. And the blame game is so effective on both sides that depending on which news channel is your favorite, you have a different side in the game. And meanwhile, while you were doing this, the administration was buying hundreds of thousands, millions of votes by giving them food stamp cards called SNAP cards. Now we have, what, 46 million people on them. When you buy 46 million votes and then you pump a million cell phones into the one state that can make the difference on who gets elected president, Ohio, and you send those cell phones, robocalls, and text messages to mobilize the recipients of those free cell phones, how can you lose? There's
well,
no possible way.
As I said in Coup de 12, as I've said for now several decades, the democracy that we hold up as the illusion of what is a democracy that was sold to the highest bidder a long time ago. And now that democracy is in the hands of shareholders, shareholders who actually are having the system work for them. It is working very well. And one of the things I point out from time to time is that every time, whether it's the Occupy Wall Street movement or whether it's the secession movement or whether it's anything else, while the media has done a modest job of glancing blows across the surface of how this is actually being pulled off, no one in the media has been willing to actually take the time or the effort to find out precisely where the real story went. And until those inquiries happen, the illusion of democracy will remain aloof.
Well, there is one guy who's trying to take that move, trying to let the people know what the shareholders are doing. And he is stuck in the Brazilian embassy, surrounded by British police who want to arrest him and deport him to Sweden for having consensual sex with two different prostitutes.
Well, and bear in mind that the data that Assange has with respect to the international communications that happen in a variety of upper echelons of public power pales in comparison to the records that I alluded to before, which are held by financial institutions, which, as I said before, will be far, far more damning, because what they'll show is the hijacking of what people thought was in fact a democracy that long ago became the investor relations front for a group of individual investors engaged in the largest wealth transfer in modern history.
And we don't know where the wealth transferred to, because every time we, the people, as a small business or a large business, go to that bank that's now bulging with cash and try to get a loan, we're turned down. What's all that about?
Well, remember that we are in a situation where the reserve capital held by banks, just like the capital and investments held by pensions, are actually known to have liquidity problems. And what you do not want to do is you do not want to be in a situation where the bank, which as some of your listeners may know, but some of your listeners probably don't know, the bank, which under the end of the Bush administration was authorized to double its deposits. You'll recall that the old signs that used to be on the front of banks were that bank deposits were insured up to $100,000. And then in the response to the 2008 alleged financial crisis, which is the, in fact, wealth transfer event, that limit was raised to $250,000. What most of your listeners don't realize is that insured deposit is not insured in the form of an insurance to the depositor. So you, when you walk into a bank and deposit your money in the bank, you're giving the bank the money under the illusion that your deposit is insured. But the FDIC, the actual agency that is set up as an insurance arm that was set up in the response to the Great Depression and the run on the banks in the 1920s, 1930s, when the FDIC was established, the FDIC is actually an insurance company for the depository institution, not for the individual depositor.
Uh-huh.
And so that $250,000 limit, which led a lot of people to put more cash into banks, is actually insured, are you ready for this, by an insurance company that holds a bunch of, you guessed it, assets that nobody believes in. And so a bank is remiss when it thinks it's going to lend out capital when, in fact, its fiduciary obligation is to hold on to deposits, which it now knows are probably underinsured by somewhere between 40 and 60%.
So we have a real quandary here. We have a lack of liquidity in the business world. If you're not already in business, you're not going to get in business. We have foreign countries that are trying to, the best way that it's been explained to me on the business side is they're trying to monetize bonds in order to create capital to invest into American startup corporations. Where do those bonds come from, and how do they monetize them, and why are they in foreign countries?
Well, that's actually a very complex question, and I'll try to simplify it. What is happening, and what is happening, by the way, not uniquely in just the case of Japan and China, which we mentioned a bit earlier, but what is happening in a number of countries is that there is a very strong desire to move out of debt-related instruments in the form of bonds and turn money into hard assets. And the reason for that is because the theory, and by the way, this theory has a fairly significant legacy of being substantially upheld throughout economic shocks. The theory is that in times of runaway inflation or financial instability, the best thing to do is hold on to assets which preserve value throughout inflationary cycles. What a lot of countries are doing and what a lot of bondholders are doing is actually trying to monetize their debt and turn it into ownership of real assets. You see very recently an enormous influx of capital where large blocks of real estate coming through distressed asset sales are being purchased by foreign investors. So enormous amounts of the real estate in the United States are now being acquired by the former debt holders converting their debt liquidity into real asset inflation hedges. And foreign interests are doing that across the United States at a record level right now. The reason for it is very simple. The presumption is that as the world continues to slip sideways in the economic headwinds that are happening in Europe and in the United States, that at least the property rights rule of law is likely going to be upheld more vigorously in the United States than in other areas. Now, whether that winds up being true or not remains to be seen. But what's happening is that people that have the capacity to do so are trying to get out of their debt asset holdings as quickly as possible and move those debt assets into real assets, in the form of real estate, in the form of business interests, business investments, and other forms of assets that have the ability to generate capital returns in economic downturns.
Well, that sounds like a good thing.
Well, it's a phenomenally good thing for the investors. It's not necessarily a good thing when the beneficiaries of that are not going to be cycling capital back into the environment from which the resources and the productivity are coming. And so, on the one hand, it's a good thing because it supports the value of assets for those who hold them. But to your point, and I want to come back because you said something extremely important, what is really happening is we are pulling up the ladder for others who will not have the ability to climb later. Because by restricting the flow of capital to only those enterprises that are already in business, by reinforcing the illusion of real estate property values because of the fear of holding on to debt assets that don't have the value that they are notionally thought to have, by bringing those things into sharp focus, what we're having is a inflation of real asset value, which makes the idea of property ownership and the idea of kind of the seeds of economic growth for the next generation, those seeds are actually currently being essentially eaten for today's bread instead of being planted for tomorrow's crops.
Yeah, exactly right, exactly right. And we see that all the time. And that's sad because, you know, small business has really, and you all know this because you've listened to all the propaganda on the radio and TV yourself, is the backbone of a thriving economy. But when you have the government of that economy at war with the very small business that it needs in order to bolster the strength of that economy, you have a broken system.
Well, and just to clarify, that is a system which is set up for wealth transfer, not for economic development. And those are two fundamentally different things. And unfortunately, what we have currently in the White House, the illusion of a two-party system, which is merely theatrics. Remember, the system is an equal opportunity corruption. This is not somebody having a monopoly on truth, justice, and the American way. This is equal opportunity corruption. And on both sides of the aisle and in the White House, what we have is a situation where the interests being served are for wealth transfer, not for economic growth and development.
Well, that just doesn't sound like the bill of goods that I was sold in the campaign promises, wealth transfer for the ultra wealthy. It sounds like they have the perfect president for their operation in place now. Is there any hope?
Amazing what a few $100 million can buy.
Is there any hope they're going to amend the 22nd Amendment to allow Mr. Obama to run for a third term?
Well, I have every expectation that if you play out the secession cards and if you play out the economic disaster cards and if you play out all of the cards correctly, you may not have that need because you may be able to actually have a continuation of government plan under martial law, and I still see that as an equally likely opportunity.
Wow. Difficult to do with an armed American.
Well, that's where it becomes very fascinating. All this Second Amendment conversation, all the secession conversations, all of the things that actually are this low simmering boil that seems to be happening across the country right now. I think what you're going to see over the next several weeks and months, and we'll see it playing out more and more, is going to be this increasingly polarizing ecosystem in which the threats to the future benefit of not only the existing generation but generations to come is going to get a fairly significant groundswell of populist support. And in a country like the United States, a country that has never really figured out how to grow peacefully, it is a particularly interesting problem to think about ways in which we can transform ourselves without reverting back to some of our more destructive tendencies.
Well, you know, that being said, we've kind of had this Cold War between the governed and the government that's been in place for 375 years, and it's worked for a long time. This mutually assured destruction promise between the people and its government. But I listened to an interview of an active duty police lieutenant right here in North Carolina. No, it's not in Charlotte, but not far away. And he said that the federal government is pouring money into not only his precinct, but all the precincts in the state of North Carolina, and he assumes all of them nationally, to train police to go door to door to collect weapons. And also to assess any level of what they call inordinate hoarding food, weapons, water, etc. And they are under orders to seize that. Now, he's in this interview revealing all this, and he is an active duty police lieutenant, so he knows what's going on. He's been there for 31 years. And he says that the young police are taking muscle-enhancing drugs, they're pumping their iron, they're buying their body armor, they're excited about it, they're looking forward to it, and they're going to go door-to-door, and they're going to take your weapons, and they're going to take any food supplies that you've built up beyond, you know, just what you can get at the local grocery. And he has said when they pull the trigger on that operation, he's going home to protect his household. And when asked when this was going to happen, he said the way the funding is happening and the way the training programs are going, it could happen in the next 30 to 90 days.
Well, I think that what you're seeing, Brooks, and I think that this goes back to the core issue, as much as you and I want to hold out the hope, at least, that there is sufficient public awareness and there is sufficient public transparency to inform a public not to be duped and not to be had. We have done a relatively poor job of staying focused, and that's where shows like yours that actually intersect public policy and science are quite fascinating. And I'll use just an example of this. For many years now, certainly for the last 4 years, there has been an explicit and very public expenditure by the United States Department of Defense for something called EMF shielding. Now, your listeners will probably know that what that means is that somebody somewhere is concerned that we are going to suffer from fairly significant electromagnetic interference that has the ability to threaten critical infrastructure. And while the Department of Defense has done quite an amazing job of hardening its communication systems and hardening its operational capabilities, the public institutions have actually experienced almost no investment in the same infrastructure. Now, when you see something like that, and when it happens in plain sight, one should look, much like you're talking about with this police officer, one should look and say, what on earth would lead someone to believe that that's a good idea? What on earth does it say to the public to have the military infrastructure hardened to preserve continuity of operations and specifically leave the public infrastructure exposed and vulnerable? The answer is that cannot be done by any organization or institution that actually has the well-being of its citizens in mind.
Well,
that has not been the case. The evidence is staring us in the face, and no one is actually taking the time to unpack it, which is the reason why a show like yours, which brings public policy and science and other issues into a sharper focus, is vital, because it is imperative that the public actually wake up and pay attention. We have been here before. This inflection was called 1912 to 1917, and it led us into the loss of massive, massive life and infrastructure in the First World War, contributed to the economic instabilities of the Great Depression, and ultimately led us into even a larger calamity in the Second World War. And we've been here before. We need to change the narrative, and the only way that narrative can be changed is if the public informs itself.
Well, certainly covered a lot of stuff, and I can tell you that the disparity between public preparedness and, shall we call it, governmental or military or police preparedness is such that it almost guarantees a relationship of surrogacy between the public and government. It almost guarantees it.
That's absolutely correct. We're building a dependency from which the only thing that can come is tyranny.
And the only solution to that is for you, the listener, to prepare yourself. And that means to put together a little bit of food supply. No, I don't recommend hoarding weapons. You won't need them. at least as far as I'm concerned. They're not gonna herd you out of your house if you can feed yourself, but they will if you're pounding on the Section 8 housing doors trying to get a Section 8 voucher. You're liable to get another form of housing that you don't expect.
That is clearly what happened in Michigan today.
Well, that's right. It's just a type and a shadow. And you know, we stay alert for things like this and try to bring it to you factually. And that's why I wanted to bring my friend and colleague David Martin on, because I don't think that you're going to find a command of the language better out there. And hopefully everything that you've listened to tonight, although it may be, as I said in the beginning of the program, a little beyond your imagination, you're safe. Don't worry. You can go back and listen to the archive again, and I promise you the next time you listen to it, you're going to get it. You're going to understand what's going on. David, I appreciate you so much for coming on the program. I love the book Coup d'etat 12. It was like 3 days of The Condor and Die Hard all rolled into one. I'm just amazed at the...
Well, Brooks, thank you so much. It's a delight to spend time with you again, and I look forward to the next opportunity to spend time with you and your listeners.
No question. Sorry to keep you over an extra half an hour, but it was just too fascinating.
No worries.
All right, my friend. Good night.
Be well. Thank you.
All right. That was Dr. David Martin, author of the book Coup d'etat 12. It's available on Amazon. I will have it linked at the archive page. I may take this entire hour and a half and put it in the free listening area because it's so important that you listen to it. We're a little late on our break. Let's go ahead and take it right now, an appropriate song. We'll be right back after this. Don't go away. welcome back to X Squared Radio. You have my promise. I am never changing who I am. Very good, very good. Imagine Dragons, if you like that song. I think it's tremendous. Yes, the music is catchy, but come on, listen to the words. Oh, my gosh. Whew. Talks about delaying his application to the Academy. That is so cool. Just a lot of neat stuff. That was my guest last hour and a half, David Martin, Dr. David Martin, author of Coup de 12. Not to be incendiary, not to be alarmist, but I want to make sure that you realize how important the times are in which we live. These are stories that I'm talking about tonight. These news stories are not weeks or months old. They are hours old, okay? This is current events. It is happening right now. Now, the interesting thing about this election is it's so polarized the country, like no other time that I have seen. And I'm not that old, a little over a half a century, but I'm an avid student of history and especially political science. And I do that from a scientific point of view. That is to say, I don't necessarily take sides. I don't affiliate with any political party. To me, it's all rhetoric and sales talk, and it's just one party trying to gain power over another party and just trying to manage its own level of money and influence. But the promise was made in the election before it, that we would have a new level of transparency in our government. And so some portals were opened to allow for public comment. Sometimes 30 days, sometimes 60 days, most recently on some legislation that has been proposed by Congress prior to when the agencies actually begin to write the regulations, which is kind of like the tires on the car. Congress, you know, builds the car the way that they think it should be built. And I would say that the bill, that is to say all of the parts, the machine, the motor, the exhaust system, the stereo, the legroom, none of that Congress doesn't have a clue about. They have no idea what's going on inside that car. They look at it at the outside. They have 2 or 3 minutes, sometimes 2 or 3 hours to say, oh, yeah, that's a real nice car. Let's put that one out. Then the real work begins. The car goes across the street to the agencies, whatever agency that law is assigned to, whether it's alcohol, tobacco, and firearms, or that's a bureau, I'm sorry, or whether it goes to the National Highway Traffic Safety Administration, or whether it goes to an agency or a department. And then what they do is they put the tires on it. This is where the rubber meets the road. They begin to write the hundreds and thousands and tens of thousands of regulations that filter down to every single restaurant, every single bank, every single mortgage company, every single car lot, every single place where you work, those regulations filter down. And they change the landscape. Now, there is a comment period. For instance, I think you heard recently on the news that the National Highway Traffic Safety Administration has now decided that electric vehicles are too quiet, and so now they need a little noisemaker on them so that those that are visually impaired can hear them coming because they're just too quiet. They completely disregard the fact that they did a multi-million dollar study in 2010, just a couple of years ago, that was quite comprehensive. It was a 150-page written position paper where they determined that the blind and the visually impaired could, in fact, detect electric vehicles 100% of the time at speeds under 18 miles an hour, whereas they could not determine the movement and location of many gas-powered vehicles. And I'm not talking about just the most quiet ones. I'm not talking about just the Lexus and the, you know, Mercedes. I'm talking about, you know, Toyota Highlanders and Nissan 4Runners, and I'm talking about regular everyday cars. If they have an electric fan that only operates in that radiator when the air conditioning's turned on, if the air conditioning's not on, those gasoline-powered vehicles are so quiet that they literally don't make any noise until they're right on you. If you don't see them coming, you don't hear them coming. But they don't require the noisemakers for the gas-powered vehicles. Oh, no. They require the noisemakers for the electric vehicles. Now, you're going to have a list of approved federal noisemakers that you can put on your vehicle. I can imagine something like a bicycle bell, you know, ring, 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 or perhaps a small block Chevy sound, the perfect whisper quiet that you were trying to get to with the electric vehicle is now thrown out the window with a pair of subwoofers on the front of your vehicle so that the visually impaired can hear your vehicle coming. What they left out was this wonderful 150-page NHTSA position paper that was issued in 2010 informed the public that all of the controllers, the controller is like the electric throttle on the vehicle, the thing that you press with your foot when you drive, you know, the little skinny pedal on the right. That controller emits a tone, usually between 6 and 10 kilohertz. That tone carries quite nicely, and the blind have learned to identify it, and so have their seeing eye dogs. And that's why they can recognize electric vehicles 100% of the time. But that has nothing to do with it. All it has to do with is control. That the NHTSA wants, again, to put another requirement on car makers to prevent, for another year, electric vehicles coming to the highway. Now, I've had people write me say, oh, come on, it's just a little $30 part. Put it on there and shut up. Well, you don't realize that that little $30 part costs $1 million to put on a car. You know why? Because when you put it on the vehicle, it has to be tested. It has to be tested, and then it has to be labeled. And guess who does the testing? You got it, the NHTSA. And no doubt every single vehicle will have to be sent to Ann Arbor, Michigan, where it will sit in a lot, and then it will be tested in the order in which they received, or maybe you can pay for expedition of that. But guess who gets to pour all over your electric vehicle when you send it up there for testing? You got it. The major car makers, they get to jump all over that vehicle, take pictures and measurements, take it apart, put it back together, do whatever they want to do with it while they're testing it. And you may or may not get that vehicle back and may have to be their model that they keep on hand. So now you see what's going on. Well, that goes even further. Go to your local restaurant. Now your local restaurant has to have a way to handle their food. Keep it cool. Keep it warm. Wear gloves. Wear hair nets. Oh, of course, that's to keep you from getting sick, you know, when you go to the restaurant. But what happens when you get sick when you go to a restaurant? You don't go back to that restaurant, and it goes out of business. You see? It's kind of a free market force that drives that kind of thing. But now let's talk about the restaurant that has 50 or more employees, and many of them are full-time. Now there's an additional tax that's on them, and that comes from another agency, the HHS. Now they make you pay a $2,000 to $3,000 fine for each and every one of those employees because you don't have health insurance on them, or you can just pay the tax and get the health insurance on them. But you see what's happening. You see what's happening. So the portal is open, and people began writing petitions. And one of those petitions, as soon as the election took place, and I mean, it wasn't really a contest, was it? What happened was that the election probably had a lot of improprieties about it, but nobody's saying anything. I mean, how many times do you have an entire county where only one candidate gets all the votes? Are you serious? Are you serious? I could take any movie theater that you want anywhere in the country, stand up in that movie theater before the movie starts, and take by a show of hands how many voted for this candidate, how many voted for that candidate. I'll bet you I could do 5,000 movie theaters, and I would get hands on both sides. Not one single one of those movie theaters, I don't care where it is, would all of the votes be for one person. I don't care where it is. I've done it. I've gone to the most amazing liberal and, ultra-liberal locations, like Santa Monica, California. And I've asked that question. And guess what I saw? I saw hands for both candidates. So how can you have 9 or 10 complete precincts with thousands and thousands and thousands of voters who are voting anonymously? All of the votes are for one candidate. Well, I already told you how. If you read the book Alienated Nation, you saw in the very beginning, in the preface, that all elections are now fixed. They're fixed because it doesn't matter how the votes are cast. It matters how they're counted. And I already told you how the vote tallying company was purchased by a European venture capital firm, and that all of the votes that were cast in America were tallied outside the country. So one of those petitions that came in was sort of a symptom of the outrage, shall we call it. And it was one by one, one state at a time, I think it started with Texas, a petition to secede from the union. Well, that just sounds silly. But the petitions got votes. They got a lot of signatures, not just a little, a lot. And state by state, they began piling up. Now, once a petition gets 25,000, according to the rules of the portal, then the White House has to answer. So, a few hours ago, the White House answered, and this is the answer. The White House politely shot down the secession petition circulating on the White House petition website late Friday, dashing the hopes of malcontents who have submitted petitions to allow their states to withdraw from the Union. By the way, one of my IMers has reminded me that David Martin has a blog, and that blog is called InvertedAlchemy.com. InvertedAlchemy.com. That also will be posted at X Squared Radio at X2-Radio.com. I would spread that far and wide. It's a great blog. He writes in it often. He is very eloquent, and you won't go wrong by reading it often. InvertedAlchemy.com. I quote, "Democracy can be noisy and controversial, and that's a good thing," wrote John Carson, director of the White House's Office of Public Engagement. "Free and open debate is what makes this country work. But as much as we value a healthy debate, we don't let that debate tear us apart," close quote. Carson offered the would-be secessionists a history lesson, explaining that the Constitution guarantees, quote, "the right to change our national government through the power of the ballot, a right that generations of Americans have fought to secure for all, but they did not provide a right to walk away from it," close quote. Well, Mr. Carson, the Constitution should guarantee the integrity of that vote. The fact that it is counted in a foreign country by a company that's owned by a venture capital firm that has vested interests in, shall we say, another outcome, means that the integrity of that vote may not be there. Now, he also invoked the sad history of the Civil War as a cautionary tale for those who would so casually seek a repeat of our bloodiest conflict, writing, and I quote, "More than 600,000 Americans died in a long and bloody civil war that vindicated the principle that the Constitution establishes a permanent union between the states," close quote. I continue with his quotations. "So let's be clear," Carson wrote. "No one disputes that our country faces big challenges, and the recent election followed a vigorous debate about how they should be addressed. We will need to work together and hear from one another in order to find the best ways to move forward." Well, close quote, by the way. So that is Mr. John Carson speaking, cautioning the American people. Don't forget, more than 600 Americans died. Don't forget, the federal government will prevail. So if we cannot vote them out, we cannot use the ballot system, and we cannot ask for secession and be granted it through some silly web portal. I mean, when I think about it, I go, yes, yeah, our state intends to secede from the Union. And I'm sure that the governor's signature is probably not one on that petition list. But nevertheless, the spirit is there, the spirit of nullification, the spirit of having, you know, the federal government get right down to the very bottom of our business. And we're not happy about it. And we don't really have a solution. I mean, we thought about a couple of solutions. I have a caller holding right now, but I want to get this point up because I know that he talks about this very subject from time to time. In my book, Alienated Nation, I have a chapter called Guess Who's Coming to Dinar. Now, a lot of readers might not even know what the dinar is. A lot of listeners, I'm sure, don't know what the dinar is. The dinar is the Iraqi dinar. Now, August 2nd in 1990, of course, you remember, Iraq invaded Kuwait and absconded with cash and gold and claimed Kuwait as Iraqi territory. 3 days later, President George Bush stated that the Iraqi invasion would not stand. The Kuwaiti dinar was taken off the world market and declared a stolen currency, so Iraq couldn't spend the money, with the exception of the locally held currency. And that was legitimately purchased by the bank. They exchanged it. Very few people knew what to do at the time. The rest of the world was transformed into news junkies as News at 11 became a 24-hour day newscast called CNN. You remember that. I mean, we just couldn't pull our eyes away from it. While we could not take our eyes off the world's first and greatest reality program, the currency barons were behind the scenes staging for a trillion-dollar currency deal. On June 8, 1991, less than a year later, the victory parade was held in Washington, D.C. A new Kuwaiti dinar was issued, and legitimate currency was traded for the new currency. The Kuwaiti dinar increased in value to be worth $3.40 U.S. in a period of 10 years. Had an investor had the foresight to invest $1,000 in 1991 in Kuwaiti dinars, they would have $3.3 million today. Now, enter the Iraq War. Would-be investors who missed the boat the last time are trying to cash in on the opportunity. Does the Iraqi dinar have similar potential? That's what everyone wants to know. And so let's bring our caller on, and we'll ask the question and see what's going on out there. Roland, welcome to the program. All right. We asked the question about the Iraqi dinar. First of all, we know that the U.S. Treasury owns a bunch of them. We know that the Bushes own a bunch of them. We know that lots of Americans bought them through their banks. What do you think is going to happen with the Iraqi dinar? And is it a solution out of this terrible economic mess?
I don't know, because I've been focusing only on California issues. And when it comes to world issues like the dinar, your guess is as good as mine.
All right. Let's not guess any further. What's going on in California that is...
Well, as of Friday, the state is no longer in debt, supposedly. They found $800 million up there in Sacramento.
Wow. Did Arnold leave it behind in a trunk or something and they just found it?
No, I think what happened was they're doing the paper, figuring out what they're going to collect on this Prop 30, the school issue here in California. So they're using those funds on going to be collected taxes to to make the state in the black.
Wow, sounds like creative accounting. But what does that mean for Californians now? Is everyone happy? Are the cities glad they're not going to go bankrupt?
Well, I think so, because real estate values have started climbing dramatically, which is good. Whether or not the kids will actually see anything in the schools improve, who knows? You know, that's way to be seen. But it seems like everybody's on an upbeat from it.
Well, that's good. Maybe everything will settle down, and they usually say, as California goes, so goes the nation. I hope that they find $800 trillion laying around in D.C., and they can start letting the banks loan money again.
Well, I just hope they don't print it for no reason at all with nothing backing it. That's the problem.
Oops, sorry. Can't help you there. It's already going on.
Yep. Anyway, I wanted to just wish you a very happy New Year, and all I can say to the band, it's a beautiful day that I saw for New Year's Eve. Excellent show, excellent people up in Sebastopol, California, and I met some other people up there, which are really, really nice. And on the way back down, I stopped in Gilroy and saw a guy named Mike Bozo, who owns a 76 station I knew, and the thing about Gilroy, it used to be the garlic, it still is the garlic capital of the world, but what's happened is they're importing a lot of Chinese garlic now to process it there because they have, you know, not enough fields in the, out there anymore. They have a lot of houses. So they're bringing garlic in, processing it there along with the California garlic, and it's still the garlic capital of the world.
Now, hasn't garlic undergone a lot of inflation, like food inflation?
Oh, yeah. Everything is very inflated out here. I don't know how it is back in North Carolina, but the prices are definitely high.
I heard somebody say the other day that dehydrated mushrooms were up something like 450%.
Wow. I wouldn't doubt it.
That's a lot of...
But I also stopped in Salinas, and this is pretty interesting. That's the where John Steinbeck was born. So I went to the Steinbeck Museum, and I met some wonderful people there also. They have, in the museum, they have a presentation of John Steinbeck's life. Did you know at one point he was a chemist for Speckles Sugar before he started being an author?
I had no idea. By the way, John Steinbeck wrote Slaughterhouse-Five, and I believe it was Grapes of Wrath, right?
Among other things, he wrote a lot of stuff. I haven't read every... What I've done, there's a book out called John Steinbeck, the Writer, and I'm going to pick up a copy of that book at the library. But in the meantime, I ordered a book. There's a book on a guy that was a philosopher in Germany named Nietzsche, and the Nietzsche philosopher, I ordered a book by by somebody that wrote about Nietzsche and his opinion of Nietzsche, a scholar. So that book just came into the library. I can't wait to read it.
Well, I always found it humorous because people used to wear these T-shirts. On the front, it would say, God is dead, Nietzsche, because that was one of his quotes. And on the back of the T-shirt, it said, Nietzsche is dead. God.
Yeah, exactly. Well, this was a book by a scholar that wrote about his opinion of Nietzsche. So what I want to do is read his opinion of this philosopher. And another book I want to pick up after I read that is one about John Lilly, Eli Lilly's son. And that's a book that was put out by another author about John Lilly.
You know, we don't have any good
model. Oh, my phone's breaking up. Can you even hear me?
Yeah, I can hear you. Probably.
Yeah, my phone's a mess. Brooks, I wanted to wish you a happy new year. And all I can say is the band, it's a beautiful day. The people were extremely nice. Lots of things going on in the San Francisco area. Seems like the economy is doing pretty well up there. and especially in the peninsula area, Redwood City and those areas, and I stopped in there for a moment.
Well, that's great. I really appreciate the call, Rollin. Sorry that the internet's breaking up.
We'll that's do all right. I'll talk to you in the future.
All right, Rollin.
I can't wait to read those books. When I do, I'll tell you my opinion of them.
All right, thank you. Bye.
Anyway, have a great night. Bye.
Well, we may try another internet connection because it seems like the internet right now is really crapping out. Hold on a second while we change it out. Okay, we'll try that. Yeah, looks like where pack speed is right back where it should be. Okay. And that's the wonder of live radio. You don't get to hear that kind of stuff on pre-recorded radio or broadcast radio because they fix this stuff and then come back and they go to a commercial and run a recording. We just let you experience the live experience of what it's like here in the studio. So as we were talking about this sort of ace in the hole, it used to be coal, you know. Coal was Kentucky's ace in the hole. It was a vibrant economy, but now coal is pretty much destroyed in the United States. It used to be oil. Oil was big business in the United States. And since the Gulf drilling has been shut down and all those jobs were lost, all the deep water drilling off of Louisiana and Mississippi, all that's gone. Now we have to rely on domestic drilling and a pipeline that may or may not ever be. We're still importing over half of our oil, and it's probably always going to be that way. So we got to have an ace in the hole, and maybe it's this Iraqi dinar. You know, in the book, The Lords of Finance, The Bankers Who Broke the World, it's about the four leading central bankers from the U.S., U.K., France, and Germany, and how they navigated in and out of World War I and financed recoveries and German reparations. You remember reparations from the Treaty of Versailles were huge fines that were placed onto Germany for being the cause of the war and for generally tearing everything up around Europe. Well, big fines were assigned to them, which, by the way, they actually paid off back in 2010. So all the damage is now paid for by Germany. Well, anyway, these central bankers went off and on the gold and new dollar standards by manipulating their exchange and interest rates and much more. It was a world steeped in insider trading and special knowledge that allowed financial powerhouses to manipulate the military-industrial complex to virtually enslave the entire world in a matrix of debt. Sound familiar? Well, we're kind of going through the same thing right now. Now, the U.S. Treasury estimates that 2+ million Americans own the Iraqi dinar. Most of them did not buy it online. No, they didn't buy it at the pawn shop or the pool hall. They bought it from their bank. They bought it legitimately from their bank. They own hard currency, Iraqi dinars. These small investors own this investment for one reason and one reason only. And that's to make a windfall profit themselves when the Iraqi dinar goes back on the market at the new value. That's what everybody's waiting for. What is the new value for the Iraqi dinar? Is it going to be a dime? Is it going to be a dollar? Is it going to be $3 or $4 like the old Kuwaiti dinar made it to? Iraq, as a sovereign country, must revalue its currency. And there is an enormous war debt to repay. There are capital improvements they need to make in their own country, and they got to have currency to be able to pay for it. Right now they're using oil. Not good. Iraq has in its possession the second largest oil reserves in the world, and they have an almost unique ability to become the shining democracy in the Middle East with streets paved with gold and clean water for everyone. The Bush administration did set this entire plan up, which is fashioned after his father's Kuwaiti dinar revalue back in 1993. Would the revaluation benefit the USA? Absolutely. The capital gains taxes and the fact that the U.S. Treasury has in its possession approximately, and you're going to be staggered by this number, the U.S. Treasury has in its possession approximately $3 to $5 trillion Iraqi dinar. And that is true, and it's not a scam. It proves that it's not a scam. That is, unless it's being perpetrated by the administration on the American people. That would never happen. Surely not. There are several differences that make this entire opportunity irresistible, even for small investors. First, the Iraqi economy is many times larger than the Kuwaiti economy. So there's much more currency in circulation than the Kuwaiti dinar. Second, the currency held by millions of Americans and even more around the world was not stolen. Wasn't stolen. Okay? Saddam Hussein didn't go in and steal the Iraqi dinar. It's already their currency. So there's no reason to do away with the old currency. Legitimate Iraqi notes were purchased for about 1/10 of a penny per dinar. Third, the largest owner of the dormant currency is the U.S. Treasury. Now, does that sound like a scam? Does that sound like something that they're never going to cash in on? Are you crazy? They just a week ago were considering minting a $1 trillion platinum coin. No, it wasn't going to be pure platinum. Come on. This coin would have been really face value worth about 93 cents. But the administration was going to say, oh, it's worth $1 trillion. Now, were they going to pay the debt down with it? No. They were going to use it to spend even more money, stimulating the economy. But the fact that they were considering it, of course, a few hours ago this week, they decided not to do it. Not a good idea. We'll figure something else out. Probably the story leaked out and it got around and they thought it was a bad idea. But did the Bush administration plan on, and is the Obama administration still considering, paying for part or all of the Iraq war by collecting taxes from the revaluation of the dinar when you small investors and you cash it in at the bank? Well, let me tell you something. That you can take to the bank. Historically, the Iraqi dinar has always been around $3 or $4 to the dinar. And this is the hope that many investors in the United States have, that once again, the dinar will reach this status. The Federal Reserve supposedly has trillions of dinars as well. Not just the U.S. Treasury, but the Federal Reserve. The leaders of Iraq have promised the people of Iraq that the dinar will reach the levels it once held, and this has further emboldened Americans to know that their investment will pay vast dividends. Hardly a week goes by that the Iraqi press does not discuss progress made toward this end. Now, President Obama signed into law the right for American citizens to buy dinars. That's why you can go down to the bank and buy them. And currently the discussion is that Americans will pay 15% of their return to the government in taxes. There is no loophole for currency trading. Currently, Americans own roughly 3 trillion dinars among all the Americans. If the dinar revalues to a rate of $3 per dinar, this will lead to about $9 trillion in new revenue that Americans have. And that's on a street level, investor by investor. And these are small investors, retirees, single old women who, you know, spent $1,000 to buy $1 million worth of dinars. You know, that's part of many people's retirement plan, is buying these dinars in the hope that they will revalue. 15% of that money goes right back to the U.S. government. This does not include the billions of dollars that these men and women would spend on goods and services that would lead to boost the economy and more jobs for our citizens. They would buy cars and houses and televisions and clothes. They would take vacations and get educations, and they would pay off debts, which would be good for everyone. Most of that money would end up right back in the hands, you know, of the wealthy. But it would take a while, and the process of it moving in that direction would stimulate the economy. The businesses from which they purchase all this stuff must also pay taxes on the revenue. Now you get the picture. So will the U.S. Treasury allow millions of average Americans who made legitimate investments in currency to reap the same profits as they take from the exchange? Well, the answer is it really doesn't matter much. In the grand scheme of things, if the U.S. Treasury reaps the profits they plan, the American debt could be reduced by as much as 50%, whether or not the average little investor gets to trade his currency. And after all, what is one more loss of $5,000 to your life savings? Well, nothing. It will be infuriating to not be able to turn that into $15 million, but it won't be the end of the world if it turns out that only the government gets to cash in, which probably will be the case. Heaven help them at the ballot box if that happens, but hear me out. What will be the effects of this? Let me begin to answer the question with a question. Who owns most of the American debt? We already discussed that tonight. China. Second, Japan. They own a lot of American debt, and they need it paid off because they're in trouble. They're 326% of their gross national product in debt themselves, and they need to pay that off. They need those bonds paid off. First, China's currency is held artificially low at a low fixed value by their government. Well, we're doing the same thing. We're printing money to hold our currency low as well. Well, there is a way to reduce the yield on those bonds by about 75%. You pay them off. The Chinese economy may implode as free market forces will demand growth, but there will be no capital to fuel it. The giant sucking sound we heard when all our jobs went to China may sound like the south end of a horse that's eaten too much alfalfa. Once people taste of prosperity, it can't be jerked away without the teeth coming out after you in the process. If the U.S. Treasury pays off the American debt held by China, it will collapse their economy. The U.S. will be out of the deficit business unless someone goes absolutely hog wild with new government spending. Yeah, like that has happened before. I hope it doesn't make the planners at Wars R Us book flights for the Far East. That's all I can say. Next, the capital at the banks that has been loaned out to the U.S. government will now be back in the cash drawer, so to speak. This will be panic time for the major banks. Without the money falling from heaven paid to them by the interest on U.S. debt, they will be in a lending crisis. Who, pray tell, is going to borrow all that money and make payments? What are they going to do with all that cash? Enter U.S. small business. With the U.S. government out of the borrowing business, because the budget better damn well be balanced from here on out, there will be capital to lend. There should be capital to lend. The credit will be extended to American business to expand, hiring people, and I mean lots of people. Working people spend money to buy things, and that's how it happens. That's how the economy begins to move. So when we think about all this and we think about how our hearts are sick with what's going on with our government, we're sick of the regulations clamping us down, invading the very small nuances of our lives, from the groceries we buy to the clothes we wear to the mattress we sleep on to the fruit juice we drink to the grass we mow to the everything. Every aspect of our life is now governed, ruled by agencies of this government. And what we want to see is a return to freedom. That's what people are stating in these declarations, these petitions for freedom, for secession. They don't want to be part of this anymore. They don't want to be in this monopoly game anymore. They already see what the bankers are doing. They're taking those pretty orange $500 bills that you get with the monopoly game, and they're adding five zeros to it, and then they're putting it back into the bank, but only they get to benefit from it. You don't get to print your own money. Only they get to print their money. And then they come in and buy up Park Place and Broadway, and it's just not fair because you got to pay all the rent on that. That just screws up the whole game. So when we talk about these petitions, we talk about the push, the philosophy, the design of secession. Does it really mean we don't want to be part of the United States of America anymore? No. It just means that we want to return to the original rules that set this thing up. We want the central bank out of our business. We want the agencies out of our business. We want the rule of law to be reliable and strong. And if it is reliable and strong and consistent and untampered with, then business can get used to it and rely on it and lean an elbow on it, and they can build from it. But when it's constantly shifting and changing, when the design is subterfuge and the design is to weaken you and to keep you off guard and to make you distrust everyone around you that works for the government, then it's something we don't want to participate in. And so various states have drafted, and we mentioned this earlier when I had David Martin on tonight, that states are now declaring their sovereignty. Well, what does that exactly mean? Well, let's just take North Carolina. This is a House resolution supporting the state of North Carolina's right to claim sovereignty over certain powers under the 10th Amendment to the Constitution of the United States. Now, pay close attention to this. This is not a newspaper talking. This is an actual sovereignty act. This is a resolution that was written, a House resolution written in the State House and ratified in the state of North Carolina. Are you ready? Are you ready for this? All resolutions start with the word whereas, so don't be freaked out by this. By the way, I want to reach out to my friends at Truth Frequency Network. They're also rebroadcasting tonight's program. I am a truth freak, just so you know. Whereas the 10th Amendment to the Constitution of the United States reads as follows, quote, "The powers not delegated to the United States by the Constitution, nor prohibited by it to the states, are reserved to the states, respectively, or to the people," close quote. And whereas the 10th Amendment defines the total scope of federal power as being that specifically granted by the Constitution of the United States and no more. And whereas the scope of power defined by the 10th Amendment means that the federal government was created by the states specifically to be an agent of the states. And whereas today, and this was written in the year 2011, so it's very current, the states are demonstrably treated as agents of the federal government. And whereas many federal mandates are directly in violation of the 10th Amendment to the Constitution of the United States, and whereas Section 4 of Article 4 of the Constitution of the United States says, quote, "The states shall guarantee to every state in this union a republican form of government," close quote, and the 9th Amendment states that, quote, "The enumeration in the Constitution of certain rights shall not be construed to deny or disparage others retained by the people," close quote. And whereas the United States Supreme Court ruled in New York versus the United States in 1992 that Congress may not simply commandeer the legislative and regulatory process of the states. And whereas a number of proposals from previous administrations and some now pending from the present administration and from Congress may further violate the Constitution of the United States. And now here's the punchline of any resolution. Now, therefore, be it resolved by the House of Representatives And there are some sections here. Section 1. The North Carolina House of Representatives supports the state's right to claim sovereignty. Under the 10th Amendment to the Constitution of the United States, over all powers not otherwise enumerated and granted to the federal government or reserved to the people by the Constitution of the United States. Pretty plain and simple. Section 2. The North Carolina House of Representatives urges the federal government as the agent of the state to cease and desist, effective immediately, mandates that are beyond the scope of any constitutionally delegated powers. Notice in this section that this declaration says that the federal government is an agent of the state, not the other way around. The state is not an agent of the federal government. Section 3. The North Carolina House of Representatives further urges that compulsory federal legislation, which directs states to comply under threat of civil or criminal penalties or sanctions, or requires states to pass legislation or lose federal funding, be prohibited or repealed. Now, that's pretty strong. That is the gist of it. That's the whole Sovereignty Act for the state of North Carolina. And there are other states. Oh, and some of these states are tough. Tennessee, Utah, they just go on and on and on. There are now 40 of them, 40 of them on the books. So what to do? We now have a majority of the states, 80% of them, that have declared their sovereignty from the federal government. We have a federal government that has gone wild. I mean, it's really gone wild. They're floating the idea of minting a $1 trillion coin, not to pay off the debt, but to give them more money to spend, like printing a $1 trillion monopoly bill and sliding it into the game because we want to buy more real estate and we haven't earned the money to do so. The states have had enough, but what are they going to do? What can they do? Well, that's what the book is about. That's what we're writing about. Alienated Nation was about that. So what do you do? All you states that have made your high and mighty sovereignty acts, as your municipalities are preparing your police departments and state troopers statewide to go door to door to collect weapons and determine the level of preparedness of the people, and if they're caught hoarding, that can be confiscated. I'm not making this up. That came from a police lieutenant, active duty police lieutenant, here in this state, that's receiving federal money to do just that. It's happening right before our city councils all across the country. What to do? Like Madison before me, I have crafted in this book, Alienated Nation, a plan. And the plan is for those 40 states to exercise their constitutional rights under Article 5 and to claim a constitutional convention. Schedule it. And here's what you got to do in that constitutional convention. Now, this is a call to action. All of you who are listening to this, I will send the book to you for free if you will hand carry it to your governor. If you're a state senator, if you're a representative, if you're a city council member or a mayor and you can have access to that governor, you can get past the receptionist, because I promise you, if I send this book, it's going to go right in the trash. No one there is ever going to read it. If you will hand carry it to them, I will put a bookmark in it to this section I'm about to read you. Now, this is by no means the only way this can be done. 40 governors need to have the gumption to get together and say, we're going to have a constitutional convention. We have the numbers to call it, and we have the numbers to ratify our decisions. And they will be changes to the Constitution, and then the Supreme Court must uphold it. It must uphold it. Here are my suggestions for saving the Republic. First, we have a series of amendments that must be repealed. They must be repealed. Here are the amendments. The first is the 16th Amendment, passed by Congress on the 2nd of July, 1909, and ratified on the 3rd of February, 1913. This is the amendment. Listen closely. The Congress shall have the power to lay and collect taxes on incomes from whatever source derived without apportionment among the several states and without regard to any census or enumeration. That amendment is going to be repealed. That means that federal income tax goes away. It disappears. The IRS no longer has a function. All the overhead that it takes to run the Internal Revenue Service disappears. The building can now be rented out for other purposes. No more IRS agents. No more IRS confiscations. No more IRS attorneys or lawsuits. All of that goes away because the federal government will not have the power to lay and collect taxes on incomes. Now you say, how in the world would the federal government be able to collect money to run itself if we don't collect income taxes? Because you need to listen a little bit as I go through the rest of the list of the repealed amendments, and then we're going to talk about the amendments that we're going to pass and ratify in this constitutional convention, because we're going to fix this once and for all. Fair for everyone inside the borders of this country. Here's the Second Amendment to be repealed. The 17th Amendment, passed by Congress on the 13th of May, 1912, ratified on the 8th of April, 1913. Seems fitting that we should do away with these two. They were passed in 1913, and they're going to be repealed in 2013. Here it is. The Senate of the United States shall be composed of two senators from each state, elected by the people thereof for 6 years, and each senator shall have one vote. The electors in each state shall have the qualifications requisite for electors of the most numerous branch of the state legislatures. When vacancies happen in the representation of any state in the Senate, the executive authority of such state shall issue writs of election to fill such vacancies, provided that the legislature of that of any state may empower the executive thereof to make temporary appointments until the people fill the vacancies by election as the legislature may direct. Now, the reason we're going to repeal this is because the number of senators will be the same, the amount of the term will be the same, but the number of terms is going to change. Have patience. We'll get there. The 27th Amendment, passed by Congress, 25th of September, 1789, ratified 7th of May, 1992. Actually, I probably should be, maybe ratified again. Maybe it was 1989 instead of 1789. No law varying the compensation for the services of the senators and representatives shall take effect until an election of representatives shall have intervened. That's it. That's it. Those are the three. Easy peasy. Now, there's still some work to do. I have served in management of several corporations and financial ventures. You may have as well. There's one thing we all know. No company can remain in business if it continues to spend more than it earns. Even the federal government is bound by the simple rule of economics. We're facing it right now. We're $16-plus trillion in debt, and if the interest rate changes even a tiny amount, we will never escape from this debt. As of the writing of this book, Europe is about $100 trillion in debt, and the entire economy totals to about $70 trillion. That's it, the whole economy. Even a child can see there is no possible way the math can work out. Europe is doomed to fail as a union of country states. The jury does not need to come in on this one. It's done. Put a fork in it. Greece, Spain, Italy have collapsed, and France, Belgium, and perhaps others will fall as well. The people have simply voted for themselves so much of the state's revenue that there's not enough to even keep the banks solvent. There is still time to fix America, but not much. And I'm thinking probably less than a year. Maybe we have 24 months before the complete collapse of the dollar. And that's only because they're printing $40 billion a month to try to shore it up. After printing $40 billion to $80 billion a month for 24 months, that's all we can do. That's all there is. So what do we do? This Constitutional Convention now has to pass some amendments. And here we go. The following amendments can be drafted, approved on the state level, passed in the convention, and ratified by a two-thirds majority all in one day, because 40 states is 80% of the country. We only need 67%. Three quarters to ratify. We have enough. We have enough to do this. We already have the sovereignty statements and laws that have been passed. These statements are powerful, and they've been passed by 40 states. There are enough. If you will write me and ask for a copy of the book, I will send it to you with the guarantee. You must guarantee me that you get this book to your governor. He has to read this book. I'll bookmark it right to this page that I'm talking about right now. If they see this and they grasp this, we can save this republic. Now, we're going to pass the 28th Amendment. This is new. Here it is. No agency, department, or bureau shall exist under the federal government, nor will the regulations created by them have any force of law in any state where that regulation is not ratified by the state legislature. Congress shall represent the citizens of their sovereign states and shall govern the agencies, departments, administrations, and bureaus. Further, the legislative branch shall have sole purview and accountability over the agencies, departments, administrations, and bureaus. Why is this amendment necessary? It's necessary because the executive branch has created a class of government office called a cabinet. Now, it's very vaguely described in the Constitution as a team of experts that agree with the president, that advise him on what to do with certain policy, because presidents can't know everything. What it has turned into is a secret organization that is run by the executive, the president. He orders the secretary, the cabinet member, to take certain actions inside the agency, like the Secretary of Energy or the Secretary of the EPA or the Secretary of HHS or the Secretary of Defense. He orders the secretary to interpret regulations in a certain way. And then they have all the latitude and purview to govern, to rule over that agency and its budget. And they assign taxes and fees and fines and enforcement actions and regulations and regulations and regulations. However, you have no representation in that government. None whatsoever. There's no appeal process whatsoever. Once that agency writes that regulation and the secretary, under the orders of the president, interprets those regulations a certain way, determines the direction that that agency is going to take, you, the people, you, the state, have no choice whatsoever. This amendment requires those regulations to be ratified by the states before they have effect. In a sense, it's a built-in nullification. In other words, if the federal government is going to manage, it's going to be an agent of the states, not the other way around. If the federal government rules over the states, we're going to war. If the federal government will govern the actions of the states as its agent, then we can save this republic. That's why this amendment is there. Now, the 29th Amendment. The president shall have a cabinet of advisors serving at his will, none of whom can officiate in any capacity in any agency, department, administration, or bureau. In a sense, this amendment does away with the secretaries. He can have a cabinet of advisors. He can have physicists and chemists and economics experts. He can have safety people and whatever he wants to advise him. But they cannot serve or officiate in any capacity in any of the agencies, departments, administrations, or bureau. That is a conflict of interest. These individuals shall also be barred from private or public service with any agency, department, administration, or bureau conducting business for or with the federal government for a period of no less than 5 years. During their service, they shall further be barred from holding any ownership, options, or promise of ownership in any publicly traded company or in any company that becomes publicly traded for at least a period of 5 years after their service in the executive cabinet. That way, these cabinet members are giving up their investment future for 5 years. They're giving it up because they cannot do away with the conflict of interest. They will pass legislation that enriches themselves, and this is the way to eliminate it. Now, the 30th Amendment. The Congress shall have the power to lay and collect taxes on any transaction of commerce wherein currency is the form of trade. That's it. That is it. No more income tax. It's gone. What we are talking about now is a federal sales tax. The rate shall be uniform for all commerce conducted in the several states without exemption. Without exemption. The tax shall be collected at the point of sale and rendered unto the United States Treasury no more than 30 days from the day of the transaction. Congress shall not have the power to lay and collect taxes from income or profits. Why do we do that? Because it will be a massive windfall for the federal government. Not only will you tax every single transaction that takes place where currency is the form of trade, but you will get that transaction from tourists, from people who live on cash and don't bank, which is about 15% of our society. And you will also get people who are dealing illegally. Even though they're making money, they're not paying any tax on that money, but they're buying something. They're buying cigarettes, they're buying gasoline, they're buying clothes, they're buying TVs, they're buying books, they're buying office furniture. When you do, you pay the tax, and the federal government gets their share. The other way that it creates a huge windfall for the federal government is, you'll remember, we just fired the IRS. 275,000 federal workers just lost their job. some of them will get hired back because you're still going to need some administrators to be able to take in this continuous flow of cash. And you're going to be able to get that to the U.S. Treasury and monitor it. And there will be some enforcement actions, as a black market will definitely form for tax-free transactions, not the least of which are, you know, cash transactions that take place where no bill of sale is recorded. That's all going to be your black market right there. But the fact that these people are going to have plenty more money to spend because they get to keep their income, then it's kind of a benefit to everybody. Let's talk about the 31st Amendment. The Senate of the United States shall be composed of two senators from each state, nothing different there, elected by the people thereof for 6 years, and each senator shall have one vote, no difference there. No senator shall serve more than 3 terms, either consecutively or cumulatively. The electors in each state shall have the qualifications requisite for electors of the most numerous branch of the state legislatures. When vacancies happen in the representation of any state in the Senate, the executive authority of such state shall issue writs of election to fill such vacancies. Nothing's changed there. The only thing that we added are 3 terms. That's it. You serve 3 terms and you're done. 32nd Amendment, the Congress of the United States shall be composed by proportion to represent each state elected by the people thereof for 4 years, and each congressman shall have one vote. No congressman shall serve for more than 3 terms, either consecutively or cumulatively. Now, there is a change. You'll notice that now when a congressman runs, he runs for a period of 2 years, which means as soon as he gets to Washington, the next order of business is to start setting up his fundraisers to run for election again in 2 years. In fact, after the Congress starts, it's less than 2 years. It's about 22 months before they have to run and beat an opponent again. Now we stretch it to 4 years. So maybe we can get 2 years of work out of them before they go into campaign mode again. Each congressman has one vote. No congressman serves for more than 3 terms, either consecutively or cumulatively. 12 years and they are gone. 18 years for senators, 12 years for congressmen. Who out there thinks this is not plenty of time? Exactly what I thought. Every single one of you listening to this night, to this program tonight, believes that is fair. And it is. And it's productive. And it's predictable. And it's strong. And you don't have to worry about somebody serving 26 years or 36 years and building some kind of dynasty of untouchability. All right. The 33rd Amendment. The president shall have the authority, and you may or may not like this one. I'm going to read it anyway because it's powerful and it's necessary. It's necessary because you've seen the shenanigans that have gone on for the last 20 years, and you're not happy with them either. And this is a way to stop it. The 33rd Amendment, the president shall have the authority to review any bill sent for his signature and to veto any portion of that bill. He shall report the line items vetoed to the American people, unless the reporting of such items shall harm the security of the United States. This is a constitutional amendment giving line item veto to the president. You don't agree with it? I want to understand why. You can call me anywhere in North America, 888-429-5471, 888-429-5471. If you're outside the country and you happen to be an American citizen, you can call anyway at 530-413-9537. If you're not an American citizen, don't weigh in on this. The final one is the 34th Amendment. The states shall have the command of their own militias and their national guards. No state shall be compelled to conscribe its militia or its national guards, but shall be free to choose service by its own consensus and sovereignty. That will stop unfunded and undeclared wars wherein the National Guard is used to fight them. If the president wants to have a war, then he needs to go to Congress and he needs to get a declaration of war. If he does not get a declaration of war, but he uses the War Powers Act to assign American blood somewhere else on the planet, then he's going to use his own federal army. Or he is going to ask the permission of the state, and the state has the right to grant it or not. Simple enough. If they come to the state of Texas and say, we're going to war with Iran, and we're going to conscribe your National Guard, Texas, and you guys are going in first. Governor Perry can say, not this time, Mr. President. Without a declaration of war from Congress, I have the constitutional right to refuse, and I exercise that right. Because the states had a constitutional convention, and they passed the 34th Amendment, and they ratified it. Now, this is not an exhaustive list of amendments. There are numerous acts in the chapter Sovereignty in the book Alienated Nation that can address the other powerful issues of our republic. They're not amendments, but they're laws, and we could pass them. Some of these issues may be resolved with legislation, as I said, but the above items must be amendments. Without that, the president still has the power to take the republic apart, and he will. Now, I got a real quick drone wars update. We got about 2 minutes left. You people in Florida need to be aware that the Orange County Sheriff's Department is experimenting with two surveillance drones that it hopes to turn loose over Metro Orlando skies this summer. Sheriff spokesman Jeff Williamson would not reveal specific uses for the drones, larger versions of which are known for flying over tribal regions of Afghanistan and Pakistan to drop bombs on suspected terrorists. But Williamson did say Orange's remote-controlled planes would not be armed. The agency still needs approval from county leaders and the Federal Aviation Administration to use them, but the FAA said it does not comment on drone applications. They're kind of secret. Well, privacy advocates oppose drones for civilian use, saying they can too easily be used to snoop on law-abiding citizens, not just criminals or those thought to be doing something illegal. I can tell you right now that the reason that these drones are being selected is not law enforcement. Has very little to do with that. The reason the drones are being activated and the sheriff wants them is nothing more than cash. Okay? He's going to spend $22,000 to $25,000 for the drones, and he's going to reap about $100,000 a month because these are coming in from a grant. He'll reap about $100,000 a month in additional traffic citations. That's the only reason that it's being used. So we're out of time this week. We need to get another host on. Thank you for being part of X Squared Radio. We'll see you next week right here. Don't go away. I'm your host, Brooks Agnew.